WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Martin Delaney has been described as part of an informal brain trust of AIDS activists that is changing the face of research into AIDS and other life-threatening illnesses. Delaney isn't from an activist background. He was at home in the corporate world and worked as a consultant to the Bank of America. Then his lover got AIDS. Delaney had heard about drugs that weren't yet approved in America, but had showed favorable results in other countries. So he smuggled drugs from Mexico for his lover. Soon Delaney was smuggling in AIDS drugs for other people, and he became active in the AIDS underground. In 1985, he founded Project Inform to disseminate the latest information on AIDS drugs and to find ways to speed up the clinical testing process. Delaney is the subject of a new book called Acceptable Risks. Delaney's first experience with clinical drug testing came before the AIDS epidemic when he had hepatitis and was administered an experimental drug. He learned several lessons from the experience.
One of the first lessons was the one of recognizing risks versus benefits, that there are trade-offs, that there's no magic solutions, which give only benefit and no downside. But I think it's important to understand that and go in and choose the risk if you choose to do so, rather than blindly assume that the drug you're going to take is going to be wonderful. So that was the first one. But I think the bigger lesson to me was more in what happened afterward. When I saw the treatments really have a potentially very good effect for me, and then because of the side effects, see the system as I saw it bring that study essentially to a conclusion and no longer pursue that avenue of research. And watching that happen immediately struck me that there was something wrong here, that why were bureaucrats in Washington making this decision about whether people like me could or couldn't have access to that therapy.
When your lover got AIDS in 1984, you went to Tijuana to smuggle out an experimental drug. What led you to do that?
Well, it really wasn't as crazy as it might have sounded. It was partly my own experience of knowing that fighting back helped, whether it was a drug or the spirit of it. I didn't have much of a concern, but I knew that sitting back and passively accepting what was coming was not going to work. You know, what doctors told people in those days was, there are no treatments, let's just wait and see. Well, you know, wait and see in this disease always meant one thing. It meant death. So we went down there not just out of craziness. It's not like running to a Tijuana cancer clinic. What we went down there for were drugs that the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health had already stated in many public forums might have real potential for the disease, and that they were anxiously trying to move forward with studies for those drugs. Well, to me, it was a no-brainer at that point for anyone who was sick to say, at least there's a reasonable chance here that these are going to be useful. They have the attention of the scientists and the researchers. They show activity in the laboratory, and you, in fact, can get them. You just had to go to a little trouble to do it.
Were you and your lover a little nervous about taking an experimental drug in an unsupervised setting?
I'd have to say no. That may sound a little arrogant, but as adults, I think the public is a lot more capable than it may give itself credit for to make choices about things like that and to take things. This was not an unknown drug. It was on sale. One of them was sold in 20 countries, the other in more than 100 countries, and we're in wide, relatively common use. And, the human testing had been done, the dosages were known, the safety and toxicities were well described. So it really wasn't a stab in the dark in that sense.
Let's talk about the two aspects of the work that you've been doing, the bringing in of experimental drugs from other countries and your attempts to change the way experimental drugs are tested in a clinical setting. Why don't we start with the smuggling? When you started smuggling drugs, was it hard to think of yourself as a smuggler?
Well, I must say, I don't even to this day ever think of it as having been smuggling. Smuggling has all these connotations of profit-making illegal activity. I never felt that that's what we were doing. I felt that we were perhaps in some cases stretching the definition of the law. But it was so clear to us that people needed and wanted access to these things that we had to do it. So I did feel funny, though. I mean, you may see in some of the scenes in the book where I'm down in Tijuana tearing my car apart and stuffing things in, where I began to feel a little bit like a criminal in the sense this is the kind of stuff you hear of cocaine smugglers and other folks doing. But this wasn't, you know, illicit pleasure drugs I was dealing with here. These were, you know, life-saving medications. And it made me angry to think that I was going through that. And one particular incident in the book was so very striking on that, where I had to make a very rapid trip down there. I had to tear the car apart and stuff thousands of pills into the car, put it back together, you know, and in the process really tore my hands up physically, which is why I remember it so distinctly. And then, you know, driving back 9 hours nonstop through the middle of the night and getting home at, 5 o'clock in the morning. And as I came pulling over the bridge into San Francisco as the sun was coming up, I thought, my God, you know, what the hell am I doing here? This is what I'm doing with my weekends. I realized that we were into something a little more dramatic than I had intended. And it was in a sort of a mental crossover point for me that said we were really on a campaign at that point.
When you were buying drugs that were not yet approved in the United States, and you were buying them in large quantities from foreign sources, did they know what you were up to?
Well, sure, they knew that we were buying them for other people. And I was hardly the only one doing this at this point. There were literally thousands of people coming down to Tijuana, Mexico on weekends for a long period back in that era. Most of them would go just to bring it for themselves or one or two friends, but there were so many people who were incapable of traveling, whether for economic reasons or for health reasons. And I think the stores understood that we were supplying them on to other people. There was never any question about that.
One more question on the issue of bringing in experimental mm-hmm. drugs that aren't approved yet in the United States. How necessary do you think that still is?
Well, it is less so than in 1984 and 85 when this began. And I think that's really a valid question, because back in those days, there was no alternative. There was no AZT. There were no drugs of any kind that your physician could make available. So at that point, it was not only a legitimate option, it was the only option. Now, today, there is less of a need for that because there are some, potentially useful drugs that are sold and available through the doctors. But not everything still falls into that category. And in some cases, useful drugs that are coming along through the pipeline are not available early enough, although we hope that even that problem is now solved, but we won't know for sure for a while. So today, I think there is less of that on a large scale, but I wouldn't want to suggest that closes it out. For example, if a really promising new drug should appear in Europe, and I can think of some where that might well be the case, I think that this underground network will act just as it had before to make sure that people have access to things as quickly as they need it.
My guest is AIDS activist Martin Delaney, founder of the group Project Inform. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martin Delaney. He's the subject of a new book called Acceptable Risks. Now let's talk about the other aspect of the work that you've done, which is working on clinical testing and trying to reform the ways that drugs are clinically tested and approved in the United States. You've been trying to streamline and speed mm-hmm. up the process and make experimental drugs that might be useful, more available. What were your problems early on when you got involved in this with the clinical testing as it was being done?
Well, in those days, clinical research existed really in a vacuum. It was in many ways, a theoretical science, very academic and intended to be very precise in ways that sort of objectified the patient, that the patient was a research subject rather than a person. And that was true both on the research end and on the regulatory side, insofar as the regulatory agencies, the FDA and that, in the early days, didn't want contact with people with AIDS. They felt that they had to be the objective gatekeeper and didn't want to be swayed by these emotional factors that come, you know, that come in your face literally when a patient is there. So one of the first things I think that we had to accomplish was to humanize the research, to make sure the researchers saw their patients as human beings, made sure the regulatory agencies saw that, and began to act accordingly. And I think that was truly the first hurdle that we had to conquer, and did so just by bringing patients to them and by bringing them to the patients one-on-one and then groups upon groups. We pressed intensively with them to imagine that this wasn't a bunch of undesirable homosexuals or drug users, put them in our shoes and say, you know, what if this were your wife or your daughter or your son or your mother or your father? Would you act the same way? Would you believe the same thing? Because, in fact, the same problems do affect the wives and the mothers and the sons and the husbands and the daughters. The same problems affect people with cancer, with Alzheimer's disease, with any kind of life-threatening illness. These are the same issues.
What were your feelings and what are your feelings now about placebo testing for people who have AIDS? Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad you phrased it the way you did, because placebo testing as a generic subject might be different from placebo testing in AIDS. The obvious purpose of placebo testing is to compare a known drug or an unknown drug, a new drug, against a placebo, an inert substance, and then measure the effects of the inert substance versus the real one. And the hope is that you get very precise information in that fashion. Now, that makes sense scientifically, but is it morally acceptable to do that when someone's lives may be lost as a consequence of it? Is it fair to ask those people to run the risk of sacrificing the last 6 months of their life in order to receive a placebo and perhaps to get good information that for people that follow after them? That's always the argument. We would argue today that in most instances, the uses of placebos and AIDS is unacceptable. And I say it for several reasons. One, because we do have useful drugs, not perfect drugs, but there are useful drugs out there. And I think there are very few circumstances in which it would be legitimate to deny patients access to those drugs while putting them on a placebo. The other reason I question it, having now watched many, many of these trials, is that I think the doctrine or academic belief about placebo trials being so precise and producing such valid answers, I think is a myth. I think that the placebo testing process itself is riddled with the psychological and methodological problems that prevent it from doing what they think it does. So that being the case, I think you have to put the ethical and human needs first.
You've made the argument to the medical profession that people have been cheating in these experimental drug tests anyways, people with AIDS, because they want to make sure that they're not on a placebo. In what ways have people been cheating?
Well, especially in the early years of the studies, there was a sort of an esprit de corps among patients in some of the studies where they would come out of the day when the drugs were distributed, some of which were placebos, some of which were real drugs, and there were scenes we heard of where people would pour all the drugs in a bowl and everybody would then scoop out, you know, their share, not knowing, you know, what came out in the mix, sort of sharing the risk in that sense. In other cases, we know for a fact that quite a number of people sent drugs out to be tested on their own to find out what it was.
Tested in a lab.
Yeah, tested in a laboratory, yeah, to determine what it was and then to drop out if it's the placebo. And still others, for example, in AZT trials, there are some very obvious changes that occur in a patient's blood work as a consequence of one of the side effects of the drug, and it's real easy to pick that out. So that's part of the argument that we made, is that to the physicians was, you're not getting the clean information you think you are out of these placebo-based trials. What you're getting is a lot of desperate people under extraordinary circumstances who will do whatever they feel they need to save their own lives. So we argued, you know, instead of doing that, let's put the trials in a different way. Let's let people who truly and desperately need access to these promising drugs, let them have that access. in some parallel fashion, and then let's recruit people into the clinical trials, not so much out of desperation, but for other reasons, and therefore you get people who are better quality research subjects. For example, there are many legitimate other reasons to join a trial other than the desperate search for a new drug. Many people join trials to get better medical quality care. Some people join them to get any medical care at all. Some people join it just to get the cost of the drugs taken care of or extra laboratory tests. And some people do it just simply for altruistic reasons. So I think by getting people in for those reasons as opposed to this desperate, last-minute search for a magical cure, you get a better quality of research subject, and in the end, you get better quality data as a consequence. And that argument ultimately prevailed with the National Institutes of Health and the FDA in the form of a system we now call the Parallel Track Access Program.
You want to explain that?
Sure. This is a program originally created by AIDS activists in 1989, myself included. Mostly it was our group and the treatment and data group of ACT UP New York that was involved in the creation of that. And what it does is it says that when we're working with a new drug that shows some evidence of value, not when it's totally new, but when we've got some evidence that of its safety and that it's active in a useful way, we go ahead and set those studies up, but outside of the studies, we create a separate but parallel track for people who have desperate medical need for that drug, and we let them have it in some kind of a monitored fashion, but we let them have access outside that. So those people who can join the trial and want to join the trial, they do so. That's how they get the drug. But those who have this desperate personal need get it on the parallel track instead. And that's now been done with several drugs, and we think with great success. In particular, the drug DDI was handled in that fashion, and 25,000 people got it on the parallel track system. 2,000 got it in the clinical trials. And in the end, it worked out well for everybody. The clinical trials got the data that they needed from legitimate patients who weren't there solely out of desperation. And the people who had that desperation factor and that tremendous need got the drug in the parallel track. And some useful data came out of both of them. And the drug was then approved quite speedily.
How do you think that your relationship with the medical establishment and the medical bureaucracy has changed in the past few mm-hmm. years?
Well, that's, again, a good question. At this point, it depends on how you define it, too. Our relationships with the highest levels of the National Institutes of Health and the Food and Drug Administration and the research community, those relationships are very, very good at this point. I think they have come to see that that many of the AIDS activists have developed a great deal of knowledge about this and are skillful and helpful in working with them. So in that sense, we're no longer the radical outsiders that we once were, and that even causes problems in the community sometimes. I think we've sold out, and all I can say is we haven't changed a bit. The system has changed to accommodate our viewpoints. Now, but if we define this, the medical establishment, in a different way, you get a different answer. If you define it as doctors, primary care physicians out there in the world treating patients, then the relationships are actually somewhat strained for a lot of reasons. I think there's some resentment of the access that we have to the top researchers. There's some uncomfortable situations that occur because we often get the best medical information earlier than they do, and that can cause conflict between them and their patients. So in that sense, I think we still put a lot of doctors and clinicians on edge who probably still assume that we're some kind of radical troublemakers who don't understand the system but somehow have access to the big shots. But we're trying to fix that.
One of the things the AIDS Underground has been criticized for, even by fellow AIDS activists, is the chance that your pressure on the drug industries to speed up testing and on the medical mm-hmm. establishment to speed up testing will help erode standards of testing that consumer activists work really, really long and hard to put into effect. Mm-hmm. And it might play into the hands of the drug industry, which wants to get drugs approved and on the market as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's an important question that needs to be responded to. if you look at what we've actually done here, I think we've taken every possible precaution to prevent that from happening. What this is really all about is the interplay of two different needs within society. On the one hand, there's the need you describe, the need to be protected from unsafe and ineffective drugs, and everybody agrees with that need. But the other need, which is equally legitimate, is the need of life-threatened people to have the earliest possible access to those things that might help them live. And those needs, they sort of butt up against each other. And where I think we've been successful is in weaving a pattern of regulation that accommodates both of those, that says, no, there isn't one immutable standard anymore, and we think there shouldn't be. There should be a strong, very conservative standard for the non-essential medical treatments, you know, the headache pills and the hypertension. There's 1,000 categories of drugs out there that are good to have but not essential at any given moment in time. But there's this other category of drugs that are essential for people with a life-threatening illness, be it AIDS or cancers or Alzheimer's, whatever it happens to be. It is for those drugs and those patients that the standards have been changed, and in a way that is that ultimately doesn't diminish the standard. It simply changes the timing of approval of those drugs. For example, with drugs like DDI and DDC that have recently been approved, they were put on the market before all of the long-term studies were in. And one could say, well, the standard's been changed there. But in fact, part of that approval included the demand that those same traditional long-term studies be completed in a timely fashion after the approval. And at the end of that time, if it turns out that the drugs weren't as good as we thought or had some hidden problems, they're going to be yanked right off the market. So ultimately, the standard is preserved. What's changed is the moment of access for the people whose lives are in jeopardy.
Has your work as an AIDS activist politicized you in a broader way too?
Well, certainly in the sense of government policies and practices, it has. I remain appalled and angry at the lack of attention to this problem that we've had from the last two administrations. There's just no question about that. It bothers me that why should I, as it's clear in the book, why should I, a business person with no particular investment in this, why did I end up in this situation? Why did I end up in Mexico scraping my knuckles apart, sticking drugs into cars? And I'm one of many people who's had to do this kind of stuff. Why? Because we didn't have an administration in Washington who took this problem seriously, because these issues could have been driven directly from Washington if we had some real leadership.
Martin Delaney, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Martin Delaney is the founder of Project Inform. He's the subject of the new book, Acceptable Risks, by Jonathan Quitney. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.